The government wants to cap total family benefits at £500 per week. Is this punishing the weakest in society or a move towards a fairer society?
It's a move by them to take more money away from people who are struggling and therefore spend less money and privatise the NHS and everything else. It's all part of an overarching agenda. It's not as straightforward as just punishing people. It's the fact that those people don't matter to the government just now.
A move towards a fairer society, because there's a big disbalance in terms of our benefit system and people who work and pay taxes.
I think it's a bit of both, and you know, different situations call for different tactics.
I guess in some way it is, but in other ways it's reducing housing benefits, forcing more people to get jobs, which means they don't have to be on benefits in the first place.
It's not a punishment at all. I personally, that's what I think.
Does society have an obligation to provide housing for all, irrespective of cost? And does a benefit culture work?
Because it's a basic human right. Housing, safe housing, not being forced to sleep rough or live as we did 200 years ago, should be a basic human right. I personally believe that. There are other countries where people can't do that and they'd like to. And we can provide it. It's easily within our means. The benefit culture has been of a massive boost to the vast majority of society, but there are some people who've become trapped within it, just as previously there were people who would be depending on their local church parish for survival. Some people have managed to slip through the cracks, but at the same time, the majority of us would love to be in work, and the only thing preventing us from being sleeping rough on the street is the fact that there's a little bit of backup paid for by ourselves and our parents in the past.
There's an obligation to provide housing for people who need it. It should, but it doesn't work as well as it could, because we kind of created this culture of handouts. In doing so, created a culture of people who don't feel they need to work, and that's wrong.
Yes, there is an obligation to provide housing, and it is wrong to depend on state handouts. But, well, the whole benefit culture obviously is being abused, and we know that. The right steps need to be taken to address the main culprits of abusing the system.
If you can get a job, so it is, you should go and afford it, but it's wrong to live on benefits just because you can live.
People need to work. They need to know from the beginning to push people to do whatever they want to do to survive, not to expecting other people to work hard and give them money to survive.
Is the problem of the high cost of housing for poorer families the result of the policy to sell council houses? And what needs to change?
The previous policy of selling council houses has had something of a long-term knock-on effect, but it's tied in with the fact that the baby boomer generation had a vast amount more money, their houses were cheaper, and now houses are assets as opposed to just homes. People need to separate housing and money, because housing should be a human right, whereas making a profit is a good thing and a positive thing and boosts the economy and makes some people's lives better, but if it's the cost of other people's human rights, then it's not a good idea. The fact of the matter is, right now, there's vast amount of brownfield sites, enough to build on for the next 4 years and build affordable housing. But private developers won't do that, because why should they risk their profits? There's no incentive whatsoever for them to build affordable housing and make people's lives easier. There's no point. They can just hang on another 10 years and then make more money off it then. And keeping house prices high is great for people who own the land and own the houses and own the buildings. It just makes life difficult for everybody else, and we maybe need to move the emphasis as a society towards looking after everybody in a very basic way, possibly taking a little bit of the emphasis away from keeping rich people rich.
More houses, I guess. There isn't really a perfect answer.
Build more cheap houses, but whether that's a short-term benefit or a long-term benefit, you don't really know.
There are a number of features that are common to all successful currency unions. A central bank that can comprehensively stand behind the currency and the financial system. The deepest possible economic integration with the flexibility to deal with economic shocks. And a system of fiscal transfers and collective debt issuance that can deal with the tensions and the imbalances between different countries and regions within the Union. Currently, it's not that the Eurozone doesn't have all of these, it's that it doesn't really have any of these. Britain is part of the European Union, not by default, but by choice. It fundamentally reflects our national interest to be part of the single market, which is on our doorstep, and we have no intention of walking away from it. So let me be clear. We want Europe to be a success, And all the measures that we'll be proposing for next week's European Council can help achieve that success.
Speaker, he says there's not 1 ounce of complacency, but he and his Chancellor are but the byword for self-satisfied, smug complacency, and that is the reality. And he talks about borrowing, Mr. Speaker. He's failing not just on unemployment, not just on growth, but on borrowing as well. Because of his failure on growth and unemployment, he's borrowing £158 billion more than he forecast. And now we know. He said unemployment would fall. It isn't. He said our economy would grow. It hasn't. He said we're all in this together. We're not. When will this Prime Minister face up to the fact it is his policies that are failing our country?
Prime Minister, our economy grew last year, but he can't find it in himself. There are more people in work today than there were at the time of the last election. But we were given.
The House must calm itself. We'll hear the Prime Minister.
We were given a very clear instruction yesterday. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the Shadow Chancellor said the government should listen to the IMF and change course. At 7 o'clock in the evening, the IMF told us what we should do. They said this: we do not think that fiscal consolidation adds to the problem. Fiscal consolidation is part of resolving the problems facing the UK economy. That is the truth, Mr. Speaker. There are two parties in this country taking responsibility for clearing up the mess. There is one party refusing to take responsibility for causing the mess.
Sanctions are a means to an end, not an end in themselves. Our objective remains a diplomatic solution that gives the world confidence that Iran's nuclear program is for purely peaceful purposes. We are ready to talk at any point if Iran puts aside its preconditions and returns to negotiations. Britain maintains a constant presence in the region as part of our enduring contribution to Gulf security. The Royal Navy has been conducting such patrols since 1980. At the weekend, HMS Argyle and a French vessel joined a US carrier group transiting the Strait of Hormuz. This was a routine movement, but it underlined the unwavering international commitment to maintaining rights of passage under international law. Any attempt by Iran to block the strait would be both illegal and unsuccessful.
The Iranians think they have total justification for possessing nuclear weapons. Now, for the life of me, can't see any case against their having a nuclear weapon. Who on earth are they going to use it against? If anyone says Israel, you can't imagine a more suicidal act for a country to perform than to launch a nuclear weapon against Israel. That would be the total incineration of Iran.
The Security Council has mandated the E3 plus 3, P5 plus 1. That means China, Russia, United States, France, Germany, UK, with me as the chief negotiator to try and work together to get that dialogue moving and to try and resolve this issue. An issue that you will know well resonates not just across the region, particularly with the Gulf states and beyond, but across the world. Real concern of what this might mean. And what we're really trying to do, and it's up to the government of Iran to respond to this, we have put out on the table a number of different ways in which they could show that they were open and transparent and that their ambition was not to create nuclear weapons. I've spent two and a half day sessions with Dr. Jalili. He knows well what I'm trying to do. And I have sent messages through many interlocutors across the world, those who know very well the government of Iran and individuals within it, those who are able to send strong messages. And they send messages back to me. They tell me they like the way this process has been done and so on. I say to them, okay, you can come back to the table. I've left everything open, everything that we proposed, and I left the opportunity for the Iranian government to put forward its own ideas. This is not a one-way street, it's a two-way street. But for me, the proof that they are serious is that they respond to my letters, to my proposals and suggestions, and they come back and talk. So, yes, I'm hopeful, but I want to see it happen soon.
The fear of Israel in Iran is very real, and the idea that there is one law for Israel and one law for Iran is one that Iranians absolutely understand. And therefore, the idea that Britain is going to be bringing its army or its navy will be seen as armed defense of Israel.
I'm the Right Reverend Sean Manchester, an independent bishop within the One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. I think we're confusing a historical figure with a novelistic anti-hero on which possibly Stoker might have based his character. But Vlad Tepes, who is the person you're referring to, of Transylvania and Wallachia, present-day Romania, was a tyrant and somebody whom that side of the royal family, Prince Charles are certainly, and the Queen, are certainly descended, no question about that, but they're not descended from a vampire, they're descended from a very bloody tyrant who engaged in mass murder and particularly horrendous methods of torture, as was common, I no doubt, in medieval times, and who might have provided some of the grist and grit to Bram Stoker's most excellent novel. But here we're entering the area of fiction, although Stoker did, of course, acquaint himself with vampire lore, L-O-R-E, and before writing his novel. And so there is much in Dracula, which is founded on folklore from actual cases. But the story itself and the count and so on and so forth is quite fictional. Vlad Tepes isn't, but he's simply an inspiration for Stoker at best.
What about modern-day Freemasonry and the Orange Order? Do you think we should take an interest in these organisations, and what are they really about? The Illuminati. Now, many people think that there's no such thing. Obviously, Freemasonry is around. Can you just give us what your view is of the various theories about these organisations, as you've someone that's studied this whole world much more than many of us?
Well, I don't have theories. I have knowledge and information, which is a dangerous thing if shared incorrectly and inappropriately. In a nutshell, one has to view that whole secret world, Masonic world, if you will, as a pyramid, and at the apex is what has been described and still is described as the Illuminati, which is the highest. I mean, it's sufficient to say that most people are in craft masonry, first 3 degrees of Freemasonry, and they would be, as is the intention, completely in the dark of anything that follows. So they wouldn't have any idea of even the next stage, Royal Arch Masonry, and what they're actually worshipping, the ineffable name of Yabalon. They would have no idea even at that stage. So how much less would they know about 33 degree Scottish Rite Masonry and beyond, and how much less even all of those would know about the very pinnacle, the very height of that pyramid that is the all-controlling Illuminati. But to discuss such things is like discussing archaic languages with somebody who is barely literate, and therefore I don't encourage this sort of conversation in such an open way, because it's rather like vampires. If they don't exist, you've nothing to worry about, and you can do whatever you want and nothing will happen to you. But if they do, you need to take a care. If demons exist, and the vampire is merely a predatory demon manifesting corporeal form, but if they do exist, you need to respect that fact and act accordingly. If the Illuminati and all that is below it in Masonic terms don't exist, there is nothing to fear, is there? But if they do, you need to really be very careful. Very careful indeed.
Now, if anyone's listening and has got a little bit nervous, where's the best place to turn? And maybe there may be some good literature.
Do you know, down the years, I mean, I did my first public broadcast in 42 years ago. And one of the things, and it happens all the time on Facebook and goodness knows where, I'm approached by folk who say, how do I become a vampire hunter? How do I become an exorcist, a demon? And basically, by the nature of what they're asking and by the nature of their phraseology, my answer is that you don't. Leave well alone. No, any more than you would take hold of an electric cable that's got hundreds of thousands of volts. You do not dabble in this area. So these people who want to dabble in the world of the occult and the malign supernatural, all I can say is do not do it. Those who are equipped, trained and seasoned to do it, and if you wish to go through the arduous process and are devout enough, fine, but you will find a way, or the way will find you, perhaps. But I personally was thrown in the deep end at a fairly young age, in my 20s, and I was thrown into the deep end, and it confronted me, therefore I had to manage it in some way.
But for many people, they feel that there is some sort of influence in their lives or their family's lives or the lives of their friends. And you seem to be implying that it's not necessarily the best thing to do just simply to turn to your local vicar.
Well, not if he's, as many are, incapable and incompetent. Almost every other day, people say, "Oh, will you bless this crucifix and will you bless this St. Michael sigil or medallion for me?" And I explain to them, if I do it, it's a meaningless gesture unless your faith matches what we're discussing. I mean, without faith, these items are meaningless crutches that you might as well not bother to have in the first place. And they're only points of focus anyway. They're there to focus your concentration at a moment of need. But if you're brandishing these items, these holy objects and Christian images, if you're brandishing them in the hope that they of themselves will protect you, you're wasting your time. A bit like the protection medallion that was given to Peter Underwood, who very kindly informed me quite recently that he has bequeathed it to me. Without the faith that is invested in that medallion, there really is no point. It's an interesting item. It depicts a knight with a Celtic cross on one side and a torch on the other. On the other side, it shows someone bearing a sword in one hand and a pointed stake in the other. But the interesting thing is the Celtic cross, because all my life I've always used the Celtic cross as a symbol from my teenage years. The equidistant Celtic cross has been something I've always used as a personal symbol. And it turns out that, and I wouldn't have known, I hadn't met Peter Underwood at that time, he first mentioned the medallion, in fact, in an anthology in which I was invited to contribute toward, called The Vampire's Bedside Companion. And one chapter by Peter, I wrote another chapter, and our mutual friend Dr. Devendra Prasad Varma wrote yet another, and he mentioned this medallion. And little did I know, all these years later, I mean, that's back in the 70s, early 70s, I would be its eventual recipient. So from Summers comes to Peter Underwood the medallion, and from Peter Underwood it is to be left to me. And so there's the connection. And, of course, my most popular work in print, the Highgate Vampire, is dedicated by me to the memory of Montague Summers. So everything comes to full circle.
The devil was part of the original creation. And if you believe in God, then you must believe in the devil. But, of course, that's nothing to do with Christian religion at all. There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. And in any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more than we know What is eternity?